Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Today, I'm kind of interested in the strategic picture as it was presented to the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the beginning of the First World War. We talk an awful lot about the Schlieffen Plan and the fact that Germany has to mobilise quickly in the West against the French and the Belgians and the British, and then, you know, needs to the plans to regroup and face a slower but bigger Russian threat with Russia's huge army. But the picture as it is presents itself in 1914 for Austria-Hungary? Is it anything more complicated? And very little gets said about this. So I'm looking once again at Ring of Steel by Alexander Watson. Now, if you've listened to this podcast in the recent or the further past, doing distant past, you know I've referred to this book quite a few times. And it's an excellent, excellent source of knowledge and understanding on the view that the Central Powers had of the problems that faced them and the threats that they perceived. And it always helps, particularly if you're listening to this in the kind of what we call like the Anglosphere world, it always helps our understanding of the war to look at how perceptions of in the Central Powers, how those perceptions shaped actions. Okay, so Alexander Watson writes, "The Austro-Hungarian army's task in a European war was at first glance straightforward. During the 6 weeks in which its ally, obviously Germany, defeated France, it was to bear the main burden of holding the Russians in the east. However, Konrad, the chief of the general staff of the Austro-Hungarian army, unlike Moltke, his German equivalent, could not simply plan for one major attack the predators that surrounded the empire could plausibly attack in a number of combinations. So unlike their German allies, with their obsessive focus on one single scheme, the Austro-Hungarians had stacks of war plans. There were plans for conflict with Russia, war case R, in the Balkans, war case B, and although formerly an ally with Italy, war case I. And of course, the Austro-Hungarians fight all of these campaigns. The army also prepared to deploy against combinations of these enemies and a case considered hopeless even by the optimists of the Habsburg General Staff, against all three in alliance. In order to meet all eventualities, Konrad divided his operational force into three groups. A echelon, the strongest group, with 9 corps, containing 27 of the army's 48 infantry divisions, was intended to provide protection against Russia. The Balkan minimal group of 3 corps, with 9 divisions, had the task of defending against Serbia and Montenegro. Finally, there was a swing group, B echelon, which comprised 12 divisions that could be sent wherever needed. The circumstances of July 1914 presented 2 possibilities for this echelon. Habsburg leaders had to decide whether they faced war case B, a conflict solely against Serbia, or whether Russia would intervene, bringing about war case B plus R. In the former case, B echelon was to be sent to the southern border for an offensive. In the latter, it would urgently be required in Galicia, what is now Poland, where, with the units of A echelon, it would take part in an attack intended to disrupt the Tsarist Empire's mobilisation. So this is a really, really complex picture. But if you look geographically where the Austro-Hungarian Empire is, it's not kind of positioned in a particularly optimal way. You know, it's smack bang in Central Europe between Russia, between the Balkans, and Italy to the south, and obviously Germany as its next neighbour. So it is going to face these sorts of challenges. One of the difficulties as well is coordinating with Germany's war plans. Germany committed itself in 1914 wholeheartedly to Austria-Hungary, knowing that if Austria-Hungary was to fall, Germany had would be completely isolated in Europe. But of course, Germany turns out to be militarily the stronger of the two powers. and is economically the stronger of the two powers, and so kind of calls the shots in the alliance, and has for much of the war the upper hand, leaving Austria-Hungary in a position where they had to fight a war with Russia that served Germany's interests as much as it served theirs. Conrad's plans, comfortingly, appeared to deal with all eventualities, yet there were fatal flaws, writes Alexander Watson, which, combined with indecision and wishful thinking on the part of the chief of the general staff, disrupted mobilisation and severely damaged Habsburg hopes of any early victory. First, the railway plan was geared to flexibility, when what was really needed was speed. The four corps allocated to the Swing B echelon all lay far from Galicia but had access to good railways. The Budapest 4th Corps could travel from the eastern fortress city of Przemyśl on a double track line. The Prague 8th and Leitmeritz 9th Corps were on the monarchy's most modern railway artery, the Nordbahn. If speed had been the priority, then it would have been optimal to transport these distant units first and then start moving divisions of A echelon, most of which were based close to the battlefront. However, Conrad's demand for flexibility meant that the army's rail experts did the opposite. B echelon was to be held stationary while A echelon was loaded into the first transports. Okay, so the question is, why is Conrad interested in flexibility over speed of deployment? And it's because there's a multiplicity of potential threats. Conrad is looking at the international situation, seeing who is mobilising and at what speed and at what rate and why and what the future position might be. And thinking, well, we need to maintain and retain flexibility because you don't know, for example, what Italy is going to do, what Italy will decide to do. We don't know how quickly Germany might conquer France or not. It's hardly, I would say, Conrad is hardly to be blamed here. The situation meant that he had to maintain flexibility, whereas in the case of the Schlieffen plan, because there were no other variables that were entertained other than get to France quickly, defeat France quickly, get to face Russia with as many forces as you can do, and fight a long drawn out war there, hopefully not long drawn out, but that was what they were kind of imagining. Worse still, the delay was compounded by the military rail technicians' ridiculously cautious timetabling. The regulation speed for Habsburg military transports on single tracks was just 11 kilometres per hour. On double track lines, they were expected to reach a heady 18 kilometres per hour. The trains themselves were permitted to be no more than 49 wagons long, comparable to other armies' transports, but just half the length of the civilian trains that usually travelled on the Nordbahn. Stops of 6 in every 24 hours for fuel and feeding were calculated into the deployment programme. How slow all this was is clear from the comparison with the French and German armies, which assumed basic speeds of 30 kilometres per hour for their mobilisation transports. These calculations matter. This was not a petty or a minor thing. These calculations are hugely important. If somebody is in the kind of like the theatre of combat, 24 to 48 hours quicker than the enemy, then their ability to mobilise their forces and prepare and everything else is obviously vastly superior. And the outcome of military campaigns is based on this sort of thing. The result was that even under the best circumstances, a Habsburg general mobilisation against the Tsarist Empire would be tardy. The Russians expected their enemy to complete concentration against them in 15 days. However, under the Austro-Hungarian military military rail plan, the final units of B echelon deployed only on the 24th day of mobilisation, so a full 9 days later than the Russians had expected. The prioritisation of flexibility over speed in Conrad's plans therefore negated one of the real advantages that the Habsburg army possessed. The Russians planned by their 24th day of mobilisation to have 37.5 infantry divisions on the Galician front, just two fewer than their enemy. By the 30th day, they would enjoy a significant numerical superiority, with 45 infantry and not more than 18 cavalry divisions. So this slowness of mobilisation threw away the only advantage that Austria-Hungary could have had. It can't outnumber the Russians, but it can get to the battlefield faster, it can move faster, and yet it doesn't. The Austro-Hungarian army could ill afford to sacrifice this single advantage, for its multinational character made it difficult to command, and the Hungarian parliament's obstreperousness had left it undermanned and underfunded. It exhibited structural complexity typical of Habsburg institutions. The common army was the main force, with two-thirds of the empire's infantry and nearly all its artillery and cavalry. Alongside it were the Hungarian Honved and the Austrian Landwehr formations, originally intended as a second-line National Guards, but which through decades of Magyar parliamentary pressure had developed into first-line forces. A small Croatian-Slovenian force, the Domobran, served with the Honved, reflecting the autonomous position of Croatia within the lands of St. Stephen. The common army recruited from all parts of the empire, while the other formations drew their soldiers exclusively from Hungary, Austria, or Croatia, respectively. The army was a dynastic force. All of its parts owed allegiance solely to Franz Joseph as emperor, Austrian emperor, or king of Hungary and Croatia. So the multi-ethnic nature of the Austro-Hungarian army, reflecting the nature of the Austro-Hungarian empire, creates kind of complexity. Obviously, you know, when in popular culture and general kind of myth about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, often people often talk about its kind of complex and kind of bureaucratic and Byzantine nature. And to some extent, this is actually reflected in military mobilisation. As we know, coordination and the speed of mobilisation, even now in the 21st century, is absolutely crucial. And the more complex and confused and chaotic the Austro-Hungarian army was, not because it wasn't chaotic in necessarily in a kind of a poorly funded, poorly managed way. Austro-Hungarian society is government is a kind of like a highly functioning system, but it's kind of bogged down in officialdom and bogged down in caution. It's highly bureaucratic, and also it is the product of the empire that created it, this multi-ethnic patchwork empire. While the German and French conscript forces were, in the jargon of the time, people's armies, composed of each nation's manhood, the Austro-Hungarians fielded, as its history proudly asserted, an army of peoples. The ethnic composition of the forces' rank and file closely mirrored that of the empire which it served and from which it was drawn. The Habsburg army had followed other European forces and switched to territorial recruitment in 1882, raising units within 16 core districts. A measure of that accelerated mobilisation and limited the mixing of nationalities. Even so, the force still had to overcome considerable communication challenges. On the subject of nationalities, this is really interesting and really telling. And the previous conversation, the podcast we had about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, pointed towards the idea that having a separate Czech, Hungarian, Croat, and other nationality groups, nationality regiments and divisions within the Austro-Hungarian Empire is one of the causes of the Austro-Hungarian Empire's fragmentation and collapse by 1918. What happens is that the various suppressed nationalisms, which weren't quite as powerful as in 1914 as people might think. They weren't necessarily going to emerge. You know, independent nation states weren't particularly likely to emerge. And there was a lot of loyalty and goodwill towards the emperor. But the experience of war and the hardships of war and the idea that you have Croats or Czechs fighting for something, nationalist ideas and nationalist sentiments and nationalist aspirations are very easy to introduce at this stage. And you know, think well, if we are fighting and being killed in the trenches, let us fight for a nation of our own. So even so, the force still had to overcome considerable communications challenges. These were resolved in the first instance by designating one tongue as the language of command and the language of service. This was German in the Common Army and Landwehr, Hungarian in the Honved, and Croatian in the Domobran. Each soldier learned 80 words in this language so that he understood basic commands like attention, at ease, or fire. The men also memorized around 1,000 technical terms, including the names for parts of their weaponry. Conversation might not be possible, but soldiers from different corners of the empire should be able to strip their rifles or service a field gun together. Additionally, to facilitate everyday communication at lower levels of the military organization, any tongue spoke by at least 20% of soldiers in a regiment, a unit of around 3,000 men, was designated a regimental language. In 1914, even though the army was territorially raised, only 142 regiments, fewer than half in total, were sufficiently ethnically homogenous to be considered monolingual. Some 162 regiments officially had two languages, 24 used three, and there were even a few regiments raised from areas so mixed that four languages had to be recognised. Any new officer arriving at a regiment had 3 years to learn its languages. The duty was taken seriously, for the men had a right to speak in their own tongues to their superiors up to company commander. And failure meant delayed promotion or even dismissal. Most Habsburg professional officers were therefore proficient in at least two tongues. The corps high flyers usually spoke more. Conrad, for example, had mastered seven. So this is interesting. This kind of really tells us something, doesn't it, about the importance that Austria-Hungary attached to the kind of accommodating and adapting to the kind of linguistic needs, at the very least, of its soldiers. The officer corps, which numbered 18,506 professionals and 13,293 reserve officers, was the army's greatest asset. The corps shared its Prussian allies' aristocratic ethos and honour credo, but its social profile was much less exalted. 2 decades before the war, the share of nobles amongst career officers had been 28.6%, but it had fallen by 1914. Most professional officers were of Austrian-German stock, although 4/5 suggested it was the in the official figures is probably an exaggeration. Perhaps 1/6 were from Slavic backgrounds. Whatever their origins, the vast majority were anational, identifying only with the Austrian state idea and their feudal lord, the emperor. Recruitment for both professional and reserve corps was blind to ethnicity and confession. One of the consequences was that Jews, who were informally but totally barred from commissions in the pre-war Prussian army, were four times overrepresented in Habsburg Reserve Corps, making up no less than 70% of its officers. Now, this fact alone raises all sorts of interesting questions about the prevalence and nature of anti-Semitism in Germany and Austria-Hungary before the First World War. Richard J. Evans, in his book The Coming of the Third Reich, makes a point that in terms of attitudes towards Jewish people in Germany and Austria-Hungary, the track record prior to the First World War is really quite positive, and the degree of assimilation of Jewish people into German and Austrian society was significant and far greater than, for example, in France or Russia, the two countries with the most kind of outrageously bad records of anti-Semitic violence before the First World War. Of course, there are these institutional bars to Jewish advancement, such as the example of the bar on joining the Prussian officer corps. And this is bad, and but in terms of the kind of the raw violent anti-Semitism and conspiratorial thinking that becomes prevalent in Germany and Austria in the 1930s, there's very little of that. Again, the likes of Hitler and the other kind of anti-Semitic kind of fringe kind of ranting sort of propagandists and pamphleteers, they exist in a kind of marginal capacity before the First World War, and it's the kind of the trauma and the crisis of the First World War, and also of the fact that Germany and Austria-Hungary are defeated, create these conditions for a kind of a marginal concept, a marginal prejudice to proliferate. And these sorts of things, they really do shine a light on this kind of Goldhagen-ish sort of ideas of eliminationist anti-Semitism, and it was always there in German society. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, anti-Semitism has been prevalent in European societies since the end of the Roman Empire. But the idea of kind of the Holocaust as some kind of historical inevitability is really questioned by the fact that Jewish people, particularly in this example, and there are others, managed to find places for advancement and acceptance during the First World War. However, Austrian officers were poorer. They had a lower social status than their German counterparts, and were often very resentful of this kind of thing. These attitudes, writes Alexander Watson, combined with a Habsburg officer's lesser social status, education and pay, comparing poorly with those of their German counterparts, influenced its command style and performance. Inter-rank relations in the Habsburg army were indifferent, better than those in its Russian enemy, for sure, but not so trusting as in the German military, even though its officers had to spend more time than German officers instructing their men, because their companies had only between one and three professional NCOs, non-commissioned officers. This was not merely a matter of communication difficulties, whereas the liberal reform of the Prussian discipline had taken place at the start of the 19th century. It was not until 1873 had the more socially detached Habsburg force finally instructed its commanders to show sympathy and get to know and understand their subordinates. So traditions such as kind of corporal punishment, flogging, and other kind of disciplinary tactics, and that kind of sort of haughty aloofness and elitism, whilst that's always going to be prevalent within European armies at the time, it was only in the 1870s that these sorts of attitudes were being encouraged to be dropped, so that there could be some sort of kind of esprit de corps, some kind of relationship between leaders and men. It's not to suggest that the German army compared to the Austrians was some sort of kind of fraternity, sort of peace-loving fraternity. Far from it. There are hierarchies and elitism and class there as well. But it was more common that a general would get down from his horse and walk amongst the men and talk to them, and ask them how they were and give them the time of day. And less common in the Austrian army. On the other hand, the corps' self-isolation and rejection of civil society probably reinforced its intense devotion to the emperor. The sacrifice that it made during the war was astonishingly high. 31.3% of professional officers and 16.5% of reserve officers fell in imperial service. The common army's biggest problem was with its men was that it simply did not have enough. Its 1,687,000 strong field army was dwarfed by the 3.4 million soldiers of the mobilized Russian force. Additionally, the low proportion of male population drafted in peace meant there was a relatively small pool of trained reserves to act as casualty replacements in war. The manpower pool from which the army recruited was very mixed. In the west of the empire, educational standards and the acceptance of state power were little different from that of the Western nations. In peacetime, just 3% of the German-speaking Austrians had attempted to dodge the three-year military conscription. If the disgruntled but well-educated Czech lands, 6 to 7% of men ignored the summons to the colours. By contrast, Hungarians, who still bore a grudge for the Habsburg soldiers' brutal suppression of their 1848 revolution and disliked the common army, had an absentee rate before the war of a little over 25%. Worst of all, were the Galicia and South Slav lands, areas where, with much illiteracy and irredentist movements, as well as high emigration, where resistance in the last decade of peace had risen to the point that over one third of those mustered failed to present themselves. Of course, war was a very different situation. Punishment for disobedience was more severe, and a wave of patriotism did sweep the empire as hostilities broke out. Nonetheless, it was inevitable that units raised in different parts of the empire would, in war, display wildly differing capabilities and performance. Skepticism about the loyalty of some peoples also prevailed, as the Habsburg War Minister's aide-de-camp remarked of South Slav reservists on the eve of the war, "They will arrive at the depots all confident, but they'll already be less willing when it comes time to march. Whether they attack over the last 1,000 meters, no one can give any sure guarantee." Okay, well, there we'll finish. Thanks very much for listening once again. And just to let you know, there is lots and lots of really cool new content going on explaininghistory.org. Do go and check it out. There's lots of stuff for students there, and some useful content in our little store that we've set up. So yes, do give it a look, and pass on the word if you are if you're studying history, and you are find this useful. Let everybody else know, because it does help to spread the word a little bit and keeps the whole thing going. Anyway, that will finish. Thanks very much. Take good care, everybody. All the best. Bye bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.